Hello and welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenpont.
Hello again, Adam.
Hello. It's been a while. We're slowing down.
We were just saying the second 50 episodes is going to take a whole lot longer than the first 50 to record, but that's okay. They continue.
That's okay. The number's going up. And today's episode, which is number 53, we're going to continue the money arc with a look at research finances from the professor's perspective. Last time, the focus on the students. This time, we're going to flip the tables. And we've mentioned a few times now that Josh is a tenure-track professor. And so really, for this episode, we're going to be leaning heavily on his firsthand experience on financing a research program from scratch.
Attempting to finance, yes. That's it. Good. I'm glad we're talking about the research program, because last time for students, we talked about salary, and I think that's quite boring for faculty. You're not looking for money to, you know, pay for rent and car and all those kind of things. It's the science.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so as many grad students have experienced, you enter a fairly well-stocked lab on your first day. I've done so multiple times in several different labs as a graduate student or a postdoc. But Josh now has a new appreciation of the effort involved in accumulating all that necessary stuff through grant applications, hand-me-downs, garage sales, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And then all of it.
That only covers the stuff, because most of the money over a research career will not actually be spent on things, although it depends a bit on the specific field. But within the paleolimnology field, the stuff is actually a smaller slice of the pie, as most of the funds will be eventually spent on either people or travel.
Yep, which are really the important things. It's nice to have toys. I really do like stuff in general. Adam knows this. I like hobbies that have things associated with them. But from a science perspective, you can't collect all these nice instruments and then not have anyone to run them or use the data from them, and you got to have some samples.
Exactly. So let's dive right in. So research funds are acquired by the professor, and most grant competitions are quite competitive. Be a rare one where it's like just a layup. You're in a lot of them, it's a case of you're competing against, you know, your peers for this limited amount of funds. And so in general, the approach is to start small and work your way up the ladder in terms of grant sizes, with success begetting success. So this is a situation, I guess this is in many ways the, the emblematic situation that the Matthew effect applies to, although it's since been applied to a bunch of other things.
Yeah.
But when you're starting, more so than any other time in a research career, some serious decisions have to be made on how best to balance the pie between salaries versus equipment versus fieldwork versus dissemination costs.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always a limited amount. There's not many people having an unlimited finance for their research program. I don't know of any that exist. And even if you have lots of money, you have lots of spending that comes with it. So there's always going to be this need to balance those different competing drains on the overall bank account.
So I guess maybe we could rattle off a bit of a list of what kind of things do you need to pay for sitting on your side of the desk?
Exactly. So I think it makes sense. So really, as we talked about, there are things that you have, there are travel things that need to occur, and then there are human resources. You can scale that up from having an enormous lab group. I mean, in paleolimnology, you're not talking about massive research clusters at the size of, like, I think of medical science as being particularly large often in terms of infrastructure and number of technical staff and all those different things. They can be very large research programs. Large research institutes, ones that come to mind are some of the big physics institutes, et cetera. Those are enormous operations with multi-million dollar annual budgets. Huge, like the
Large
staff.
Hadron Collider?
The Large Hadron Collider, the Snow Lab at Queens or out of Queens that studies neutrinos, among other things. Those are amazing facilities. Nobel laureates run those facilities. But they require huge infrastructure and huge operating funds. But you can get that down to very small. You know,
they're not be the average research lab, is what you're saying.
Absolutely not. No, and the average is probably skewed, you know, to a pretty large tail on the small end. There's people who have a couple of graduate students. They may go to a conference. They may do a little bit of field work, often quite local. They have a few instruments that they need to be running, and they can work on relatively small amounts. So it's very scalable. But if you're starting a new job, there are certain things you need, right? If you are starting a job, many people start in July, you know, start in the summer. That works well with the hiring timing and all those things. And so what are you going to do when you first arrive in that thing? The thing I was surprised at, I had to pay a little bit of extra money for my computer on day one. I got a desk, I got a chair. I got a certain stipend towards my computer station, workstation. But if I wanted an extra monitor, I had to have the money for that. And if I wanted, you know, an upgraded CPU, say you were going to be using that for computing, high performance computing broadly, and you wanted to upgrade that, that's not going to be supported at every institution. So that's something to keep in mind. That there are upfront costs that you maybe just don't never even really imagined might be there.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here for a second. But there's some element of startup funds associated with each lab, though, isn't there? Or most, if not all, situations.
Yeah, and this may be a topic for another arc or whatever, sort of the negotiation and starting a job and that kind of thing. Maybe it doesn't deserve its own arc, but it's not really tangential here. But to say, most new hires will get some startup funding. The amount that is, it ranges hugely depending on the faculty you're in, the department. This is something that sometimes could be negotiated. Cluster hires often have different pots of money. In some places, they'll give a very large startup, but then they'll claw some of that back through other initiatives. Like if you get a infrastructure grant later on, tons of variability. But most people do get some startup funds. And that's to deal with all these things, to deal with the basic things to begin with. Hire that first couple students before you've had time to apply for grants. Get in the field, buy some stuff, and then just have that. And one of the nice things about startup is it can be used for pretty much anything.
Okay, so start in July.
Or January. Oh. I mean, January might be worse in some ways because you're so much further away from kind of when funds are often dispersed at the beginning of new year. You're never going to get money given as a grant for a fiscal start if you start January 1. You just didn't apply in time. So.
Okay. But anyway, so you got a desk, you got a chair, you got a computer. You have to make a decision about whether you have a field season that first year. Will you have data? Again, this is field dependent, but paleo, you know, most likely you want to collect something to measure. You're going to need to recruit students, which is a whole separate ballgame. But the key thing that we're talking about today is that you'll need to pay some portion of their stipends.
Yep, that's right. If you did get into the field and you brought back some samples, you're probably going to want to do some analysis on that, or have the laboratory infrastructure to prepare those samples for diatom analysis, to freeze dry those samples if you have kind of infrastructure things available. It often will depend on what you can borrow at that time. You probably don't have enough startup to purchase a freeze dryer. They're very expensive for basically just being a refrigerator and a vacuum. Maybe those exist in there. You want to send some samples off and get some radiocarbon dates or lead-210dates. Those are all things that have to be paid for, because you're unlikely to have a gamma counter in your lab to begin with.
Yeah, because what would a gamma counter go for?
The counter itself?
Yeah. Or at least John always, to get it up and running.
John always said they were like somewhere between a quarter and a half a million dollars. I'm not sure how that has changed with inflation, but they're very expensive items.
And then how much should it cost if you want to use somebody else's gamma counter?
I think the going rate is between $125 and $140 per sample. So, you know, $1,500 to data core, kind of on average. Again, lots of variability there, but that's the ballpark we're talking about.
In the order of magnitude, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's that trade-off. You know, dating a core is obviously super important. You may have students that you've paid who can count diatoms, count chironomids, cladocera, which is a little less expensive. But if you want to send samples off for metals analysis or for isotopes or any of those things, those can be pretty expensive for analytical costs.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, $1,500 for core. All you got to do is analyze 300-ish cores, and that gamma counter pays for itself.
You know, when you put it that way, that's right. Very good point. 300 cores. That's the trade-off point. Yeah, that's right. Not to mention maybe needing that much money up front. But yeah, I'm sure the university would spot me the money. I just have to just tell them that I'll date 300 cores before the life of the instrument runs out.
Come on, let's do this. You know, like in my PhD thesis, how many full cores did I do? It was about half of it. Did like 7 or 8. Yep. Some top bottom stuff. I mean,
yep.
Let's just round it up to an even 10 for PhD student. 30 PhD students, boom, covered.
That's it. Perfect. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think in my whole career, I've probably, you know, worked on maybe 50 cores, something like that. Only been doing this for 15 years. So, yeah, 6 times that. Yeah, that's about 100 years of research, give or take,
for an individual,
one person.
You'd be stupid not to.
Yep, that's okay. It, exactly.
All right. But then I guess the other thing with things like gamma counters is you have annual maintenance costs on serious equipment, even on not serious equipment. I guess, you know, you just have just regular lab glassware, you know, annual breakage type costs and replacement costs.
And all the disposables, gloves, chemicals. A case of slides is surprisingly expensive.
This is a place to say how much a case of slides.
I don't know, a few hundred bucks a minimum. I haven't bought a whole case in a long time. I think, in fact, I've never bought one. There's just been kind of one that's been there. But getting to the end of it, I'm going to have to look that up soon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, more than you would think, right? I mean, it's the numbers themselves don't matter. The key is that it adds up.
Yeah,
you can easily go to the science stores on campus and just get pipettes and Sharpies and tape and gloves, and you're out for $400 easily. And it, you know, if your startup is $20,000 for a year, or $100,000 total, or I mean, the numbers don't matter. That's a pretty sizable proportion. So you do need to find some more funds to top those up.
And before we get into those funds, we talk about annual maintenance, this cost of disseminating your research. I guess one thing we didn't really cover in the notes, but worth introducing here, is you don't have to pay to keep the lights on, do you?
No. No. That is, well, I'm not sure every place. I can't say every location. So as it works in ours, that is something that the faculty covers. So the university does charge the faculty for the space that it occupies. It doesn't charge per se for like amount of lights. There's not someone who comes and reads the meter every month. It has to do just with the area that the lab and then all of our offices and all of the other space, classrooms that are ours, etc., take up. And you get charged a certain amount per square foot. In other locations, it's not impossible that they do directly bill the faculty member as opposed to the department or faculty covering that. We don't pay those costs directly. That would be covered by the overhead and things like that that come with granting.
Do you want to talk about overhead? Or is that like?
Yeah, I guess that can come up. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute when we start talking about. And that's actually something that you would have a obvious probably a much better idea to or information to share.
Yep. All right. Well,
but you're right about the disseminating research. Just to stay on topic here, is that disseminating means publishing, obviously, which is becoming something that many people have to pay for as we move into a much more open access environment where article processing charges, APCs, are charged, and they range by quite a bit, you know, from $1,000, $1,500 up to many thousands of dollars for some of the journals.
Yeah.
But a really important part of dissemination is to go and disseminate those information to conferences. And that adds up very quickly, as anyone who's ever been to a conference and submitted their own claim, like a graduate student listening will remember. And that money has to come somewhere too.
So where do you get the money then?
Where do you get the money? The age old question. Anywhere you can is probably the most important thing to say, and lots of little pots. It's not unlike the graduate student funding we're talking about. The first thing I would say is the startup is really important. So if you are hired, negotiating, more startup is always going to be beneficial. And one of the nice things about startup is that it really doesn't have any strings attached to it, right? There's no other than this is for you to get going with your research. There's no stipulation that this has to go towards salary, or this has to go towards this project, or this has to go towards this. So startup is really useful in that perspective. And it's also really useful to kind of hold on to. There's this, I think a lot of people have lived and researched quite meagerly when they first start their professorship. They didn't come from this, you know, what we're calling the fat cat professor lifestyle. And so there's and you want to do all the things right away. Like you want to hit the ground running hard because the tenure clock has started and you just have all these ideas and you've just gone through the interview process and the hiring process. And you want to spend it all. You want to, you know, do that massive field season, hire everybody, buy all the things. But that may not be the best case, because if you don't, you know, access some of these other funding sources, then you'll want those funds because they can do almost anything. So holding on to some of those until you know you have a few other streams coming that are a little bit longer term is a really important lesson and some good advice that I got.
Okay. All right. So startup funds from the university itself.
Yep.
Then you start applying to grants and
your friendly grant. What are you? What's your job title?
My title. Well, I think most places would call me a research grants officer.
Okay.
Specifically at Queen's, I'm a research projects advisor. So RPA is my title, but more broadly, when you're looking up on NSERC, like talk to your RGO would be the NSERC speak.
Right. There we go. Right. Yeah. Who can help? Right. Because where do you apply for all these things? As a grad student, postdoc, you know a few, obviously, but there are other ones. There are internal ones, which may not be your purview, but they do exist. There's going to be someone in your department, faculty, university with information on more internal funding opportunities. Most of those tend to be a little bit smaller. So minor research awards, they all have different names, small research grants, whatever they are. But those, you know, absolutely very valuable, tend to not have as arduous application processes as the bigger Tri-Council or other, you know, funding agency grants. So those can be used for great work.
Yep. And they scale up. And so I guess, so you have internal, in many ways it parallels the student experience. So you have internal awards that you can apply for, which tend to be smaller in scale and much more focused. And then you could go to federal or provincial type of grants when we talk about, I guess, within paleolimnology, most of our work would be funded by the, I guess, tri-agency, like the research funding body, NSERC, which would be like the science and engineering funding body in Canada. At a federal level, it's split between like natural sciences, health sciences, and social sciences, basically. And everyone refers to them by their acronyms, so NSERC, CIHR, and SHRC. But basically, those are a lot of standard, you know, pots of money. And that's where you, instead of startup funds, you'd be looking for research project funds. So like, write a grant, I want to do X, and this is why you should give me the money to X, because it is important in this way and or that way. There's a small number of more open-ended grants that are more research program grants. And the big one that Josh should be intimately familiar with would be the Discovery Grant Program, which is kind of like, in many ways, seed money to get a research program running on a baseline level. The money's not tied to doing a particular project per se, but lots of other grants are. You also have what I would broadly
and there are to. Just to say that, sorry to interrupt, but there are analogs in everywhere. NSERC is mirrored by, in the UK, I think it's NERC, you know, so not whatever. There's not the US National Science Foundation, NSF grants, there's a lot of programs under their banner, but there are similar kinds of things in there, and they tend to be big money. So they kind of link in with some of the other things that I think Adam is just about to jump into talking about. So just to keep in mind that there are lots of other similar things out there. Exactly. But yeah, to do research on specific projects or kind of to fund your program of fundamental research.
There is a whole subset of grants that I broadly class as partnership grants. So that can be, so instead of being directly funded by, you know, hello, Government of Canada, give me X amount of money to do these projects, it's a little bit more, you go find a partner that might be interested in contributing 25%, 50% of the research funds, and then the funding agency will provide the other half. But what will happen in all of these cases is that it's much more targeted research at this point. Like, you may approach them in an open-ended way, but the partner that is providing half of the research funds will be interested in a particular thing. And that's what the research project will be all about. And in the NSERC world, there's a huge umbrella program called the Alliance Program that is absolutely tailored at this. And the partners can massively vary, whether it is academic partners with other institutions or other countries, with private partners. And so this is like basically one way that our federal government kind of looks to fund science and innovation by kind of like doubling the money that you invest in research coming from the private sector, and also similarly the public sector. So in many cases, a government agency might be your partner, and they might have some operating budget to do X, Y, and Z on a maybe more of an analytical level or something like that, but they don't have dedicated people to do the field work and the microscope work in a paleolimnological sense, but they might be interested in the data, and they might have these gamma counters or other analytical tools that they're willing to put forward as in-kind contributions. And
water chemistry, things like chemical labs. Yep, exactly.
And so there's a huge, I guess, spectrum of what is available in a partnership grant level. And I guess, yeah, that'd be in my current life I spend a lot of time dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good, from the government perspective, it's a good investment, right? They're putting in a certain amount of money, but more is getting done with it based on other sources, is one way to look at sort of the take on that. Plus, it does give some indication, like when they're giving money to fundamental research in the Discovery Grant Program, that's up to a body of experts to say, yes, this is interesting, it's well written, it's well thought out, we're going to get a good investment on that. But there's never any guarantee that's going to be tailored to some sort of innovative output. Whereas partnership grants, this is maybe more likely that there is a patent at the end of this, if that's the area that you're working in. Not going to be the case for paleolimnological research necessarily, but we can find ourselves under similar types of granting structures, because it's not only designed for innovative kind of research, though there are those programs that are only for that as well that we just don't know anything. Well, I just don't know anything about. I'm sure Adam has to deal with them occasionally.
Yeah, this, I guess this is one thing where at times I'm sometimes amazed about, you know, what I didn't know about what I didn't know at grad school and what is out there and in the partnership grant world and the whole idea of double leveraging where, you know, you can take your partner's money to one particular program and they will double it and then combine that with something like MITAX, which has got a focus on training students. And as long as some portion of the money is going to student salaries, you know, they can double it again kind of thing. So the idea is to create a win-win-win scenario where, you know, you're creating money for fund training the next generation of scientists. The government is furthering pure research on some level and at the same time fostering economic development by putting money into private R&D that smaller companies or even bigger companies, but whatever, a particular avenue of research that would not happen otherwise without the kind of nudge in terms of the leveraging of the funds happening through the granting programs.
For sure. Yeah, so those are ways in which much of the project-specific research ends up getting funded in a Canadian context. If you're working in larger sums of research money, it's unlikely to be internally funded. There has to be some sort of external funding from the university, or from the federal or provincial governments, or both, and or linking in industry for sure. That it, for a lot of people is really the bulk of the money that comes in to run projects and fund research.
Yeah, because I think in terms of the sums of money being involved, so if you talk about the basic discovery research program, if that was your only funding source, you know, you're going to have a rather small lab. Like you're not going to have more than one or two students at any one time. At most, so if you're looking at any lab where there is like a, you know, a student office, let's say, then that professor will be very likely have multiple research partnerships at play.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, that's just what's needed. The funds are not sufficiently large to have five grad students and the field work and the travel and the analyses that go along with them. It's just not going to be sufficient.
Without tapping into a broader research network of some kind.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the other thing we haven't talked about. Partnership grants often have multiple PIs, different universities often incorporated into them in the same way that many of the more project-specific grants do. So getting in on those kind of network opportunities, whatever granting program they fall into, can be really, really important, especially when you're at the start of your career, because it does contribute into that, what did you call it before, the Matthew effect? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea of sometimes these people are more established, not sometimes, these people are more established. They have the research infrastructure, they have the history perhaps of working in an area, and you're bringing this toolkit to bear in that area. They know more people. They have had more grants. Their CVs are more complete and larger. There's lots of reasons that hitching your stakes to a new collaborator, an old collaborator, whoever it may be, is a really great idea. And you get to work with cool people, and that can be a great part of it. But if it brings in a few bucks, that works quite well as well.
And part of the intent also, I guess, one that didn't scribble down here, Ola, but you build a broader network outside of academia, and that in many ways can create pathways for your students to pursue careers once they complete their studies as well.
For sure. Absolutely.
And that's part of the purpose as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. When you talked about MITAX, I mean, that's a stated part of the reason for that program is to introduce people into, you know, the potential to work in those industrial kind of lines in some cases.
As effectively their main purpose, I think. been a while since I dug into the history, but I think their initial purpose is it was very math focused, and it was supposed to be a math, create links between math and industry to find an avenue for math graduate students to find careers that were not necessarily in academia. Because keep in mind that in order for any given research professor to replace themselves, they need to generate one student.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Very true. I mean, we could always grow the discipline, but you know, if in a career you have 20 PhD students, a number of them are not going to end up in academia, for whether of their own choice or because of the job market, whatever it may be.
Yeah. And so that is another purpose of the partnership grants, is just to like break down some of the barriers in the, you know, so-called ivory tower with broader society.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing we were talking about, that's primarily, we've kind of been talking about for the last little bit, is to fund specific research programs. But there are granting opportunities within this structure, federal, provincial, that are for other things. So for infrastructure, for example. So NSERC, we were just talking about, has a research, what's the T in RTI?
Tools.
Tools, there you go. Research, tools, and infrastructure.
Instruments.
Program. Instruments?
I'm 99% sure it's instruments.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. It makes more sense. Because it is for things. Anyway, they fund buying stuff, buying cool toys to do science. And I got the research part, right?
Yeah.
So that's good. Perfect. And another one that is not funded by, it's federal, but it is not one of the tri-councils, is the Canadian Foundation for Innovation, CFI, which for many labs, is going to be the biggest buy of stuff that ever happens. There are programs for sort of new hires or are commonly used by new hires. There are larger infrastructure grants that are through CFI that people can tap into it at other points in their career. But they really are for big ticket items.
Like gamma counters.
Like gamma counters, like... all sorts of things, ICP-MS, spectrometers, for really anything you can imagine. Like if you can find it in the catalog of some company that produces equipment, you can justify it to CFI if you can make that justification. And that is totally separate from, you know, your startup funds, NSERC money, any of those kind of things. That is to buy things and do things. So you can renovate spaces, for example, with that money as well. It's really about setting up your laboratory and what the things you need in it.
Yeah. And that's And so it's a key different stream, because that's going to be a tough sell to a partner. It's like, there's a $500,000 piece of equipment I want to buy. If you give me half of the money, I can get NSERC to give me the other half of the money, and then I'll go along my merry way. That's a tough
right.
sell.
And then I have a walk-in fridge. You know, for things like that, right? Like, it's never going to be sexy to say I need to buy a freeze dryer or a fridge, but you need those things. And this is a good way to do that, because, yes, there has to be innovation. It's in the title. It needs to be. But that can be about the research. The research can be innovative, and you can buy things that seem quite mundane. You know, you want to have a couple of fancy big ticket items on that buy somewhere, so you can sell the latest drone or the best microscope or those kind of things. But it's also okay to say, you know what I really need to do is I need a new fume hood. The one that's here is 70 years old and I don't think it works very well anymore. And that's fine too, which is also quite useful.
I guess another tangent about, particularly about expensive instruments, is the possibility for commercial prospects is the wrong word, but some self-funding by using it when you're not using it to do that $125 a sample type stuff.
Yeah, cost recovery.
There we go.
That's for the instrument. Absolutely. If you have any instrument, I mean, you could charge for samples to be run. It could be done internally. There are instruments that are not just for paleolimnology. You know, if you have a spectrometry facility, you have a elemental analyzer, you have those things, or maybe people in engineering, other people in your unit, if you're in a geology or biology, geography unit, that want to run samples, and you know, that would pay for, you know, you could charge them cost, be a really good colleague. You could charge them a little bit more and maybe pay for
the associated consumables.
Yeah, tank of oxygen, the consumables, the annual maintenance can be quite expensive, as we said a minute ago. You know, it could be thousands of dollars to maintain these instruments, and it's nice to be able to at least cover that part of it. Yeah, so that's a very, you know, you're not going to pay for field seasons on that kind of money unless you have a couple gamma counters dedicated to full-time samples for other people.
Yeah, you're not going to be running a commercial operation, but you...
No.
Exactly. I guess it's more an idea of like, than not sitting there gathering dust in between your own samples.
That's a very good point, because a lot of instruments like to run. So our elemental analyzer likes to run. It doesn't like to be sitting. You get better results the more it runs. And that's part of it. Good point.
Okay. And then I guess, so we kind of touched on the gear and timelines and things like CFI have to be planned years in advance in some cases.
Yep.
But a key thing, I guess this never really crossed my mind as a graduate student, but it becomes more of an issue as you become established. If you choose to move, what happens to all your stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have any intentions of moving. If anyone from York is listening, I'm not thinking about this. Just going to preface it with that.
But I've seen other people move. How about that?
Was in the middle of it. I helped Mike Pizarik move a number of his things when he went from Carleton to Brock. So he took some stuff with us. It fit in about the size of a U-Haul truck, the things that he had, though admittedly many of those were his samples, which makes sense that he would, you know, those would be his. So I think it really does depend. A lot of cases, it depends on what the source to buy those things were. So things that were purchased with CFI funds belong to the university. I think that
would be, and this is where I can be put my RPA hat on a little bit. And then there's even a distinction within our office between, like, quote unquote, the grants office, which is like funds that you would apply to, versus institutional programs, which are grants which the university applies to and then allocates a certain amount of funds to the professors from their broader quota.
Exactly. And you know, it's tied down. A lot of these things are big, obviously.
Bolted to the ground, literally.
Those belong to, exactly, quite literally, or built into the fume hood or walk-in fridge or whatever, those kind of things.
That's my building. I'm taking it with me. That's my large Hadron Collider. I'm taking it to my new lab in Japan. Thank you very much.
Good luck. Yeah, that's right. Versus other things, maybe not. So there is a thing to consider, obviously. Generally, I think your slate is quite a bit cleaner when you would move to a new location. You will have left many things behind. Your students, obviously, are left behind. Some will end their program and come and join you, but that's very unlikely. They're going to finish there. So you're relieved of their salary costs. I guess that's one thing to think about.
This is horrible. But, I don't talk about this anymore.
But you also no longer have their shining company. So that's definitely something that would have to be considered. And frankly, what I was joking about, not thinking about it, it just seems like an incredibly tiring proposition to start over again. It's hard to do the first time. I don't know if I would want to do it again, to start in a new location and go through all that, learn all the things about the system and how to fund these things and the internal kind of structure, because every university is different, and then to get going again,
seems so daunting, and you know, seeing it, you know, both as a grad student of, like, you know, someone moving in that has come from another university and seeing, but yeah, I cannot imagine how much of a headache that must be.
Yeah agreed. Though there are obviously good reasons, and people do it.
Yep. But
so it just has to be factored into the mental calculus.
Yep. This is one thing where I differ in my, like, you know, graduate student career from you, is that I definitely had, like, a firsthand experience in both walking in on day one into a established lab versus a starting lab, which I think, I don't know if that affected my perspective at all of like on when I first arrived at Queens and like I was like, there's so much stuff here.
Oh God, it's so shiny. All the floors are marble or whatever.
As opposed to, you know, walking into a lab where I was, you know, the very first undergraduate student and there was like one master student who had started 6 months earlier, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, it's funny, eh? I wonder, because I only ever started an established lab. So it seemed like everything was there. I wonder what the experience is. They probably don't know any different, but like of our graduate students, like maybe Jenny's kind of getting there in terms of the infrastructure. But some days it feels like we're only just kind of getting everything sorted. Like this week we moved our microscopes into what I hope will be their permanent home. I've been there a year. She's been there 7. So it does take time. I think as with anything, there's trade-offs, right? The what I call plank holders, so that's like an old Navy term for the first crew on a ship. They get a lot of your time, right? They get a lot of your energy because there's less of them. You don't have the senior people to share methodology, and you know, so I work on the microscopes quite closely with the students. There's no one else to help them with their diatoms, that kind of thing. You know, their projects are my projects, you know what I mean? They're like really dear to my heart. I don't have a lot of other things going on, so they definitely get a lot of HR sort of support, but they may not have access to all the tools, you know.
Well, yeah, well, it's interesting because I compare, so the I did my undergraduate lab with Roland Hall in Waterloo. And so when I first arrived, it was very much, there was a lot of hand-me-down equipment in there, but it was also, I was his first undergraduate student. And then, you know, on many days, there was literally nobody else in the lab when I was learning diatoms. So I'd call over to his office, like, Roland, can you tell me what this is? Roland, can you tell me? He's probably trying to write his very first grants at the time, but I was oblivious to that. And, you know, he was intimately involved in every step. But, you know, by the time I went to the, you know, do my PhD with John at Queens, you know, I was studying a, you know, proxy. I was looking at invertebrate remains. John had never looked at invertebrate remains. And, you know, I could have called him over and he'd be like, that is not a diatom.
Yeah, that's right. I think it is I'm pretty sure it is a coronamid or a cladocerin. Yes.
And so like the level of direct involvement is night and day, because he was more this big picture. He had, you know, his background was algal, but there's lots of people in his lab over the years that had developed expertise in other proxies.
Yeah, exactly. At that time he's CEO, CFO, and COO of the whole corporation, but not, you know, he's not managing individual
product
bits at that point. Yeah.
Product lines.
Yeah, exactly. Product lines, exactly. So an interesting comparison, and there are benefits on both.
Oh, yep. Oh, absolutely. So I think like we talked about the big picture items that we wanted to cover, but at this point, I think even just when I started thinking of what I could pick your brain about, you know, it's just general questions that I've always been wondering, like. Okay. How much does it cost?
9:50 p.m. is definitely the best time to get straight answers out of Josh. Perfect.
How much does it cost to rent a helicopter? I've never rented one.
It depends on the helicopter. Yeah, it depends on what you want in terms of the instrument. The ones we use for research, so like the ones that are supported. Oh, that's the other thing we didn't say. Like some field-related things. So we get money from as in-kind support for helicopter operations from Polar Continental Shelf Program, for example. So you submitted an application to... a project description for what you're going to do, the logistical requests, and they will often cover some or all of the helicopter support up to a certain amount. So this year I got 12 or so hours of helicopter time that they were willing to pay for. They coordinate all the logistics, and I just had to go and do the work, sign off on the things, and I never had to pay them and then get reimbursed. It was all done on contract. It only is if you're working in the Arctic, obviously, or the North. I think it just has to be north of 60. Don't quote me on that, but that's my guess. But there are other programs for those kind of things. Anyway, the helicopters we pay for, just to answer your question, that they pay for, are about $1,800 an hour, something in that range.
Okay. And what does 12 Canadian hours dollars. Of helicopter time actually translate to?
It's a real good question. Depends how you use that. So if you buy a helicopter, if you go, this is getting a little into the weeds here, but if you go and order, if you go and just say you want to rent a helicopter, there may be minimums for the day. So the minimum that they'll let you rent it for is 3 hours, say, because other than that, it's not really worth the effort because it could be doing a longer job and just ferrying people around. That's not always the case, but in some occurrences, that is. That's not the case with PCSB because they basically buy a helicopter in Inuvik for the whole year, for the whole summer. So, you know, if you only use 1.8, so the minimum they'll run is 0.1. So 6 minutes is the minimum startup time. Every time they turn on the helicopter, that's when you're paying. It only is counting as hours when the thing is running. So if it's sitting on the ground running or if it's flying. So you could you
so 12 hours is more than 12 hours.
12 hours can be a lot more than 12 hours. So that is usually I budgeted over 4 or 5 days of flying. But you can go through hours really quickly. So this summer, I think the shortest day was a 1.8. And that was basically going out to a couple sites, moving a few times. Maybe we came back and fueled once. And then, you know, that was 8 or 9 hours of total daytime, most of which was it just sitting on the ground and the pilot sitting reading. Versus another day, we had the helicopter on fixed floats. So they had pontoons on the helicopter so it could land on the water, where we used 4.5 hours straight through. Like we went, you know, from 8 o'clock and at 12:30, we had used 4.5 hours. And that was my day, basically. We got a lot of samples in that time, but you know, it was lunchtime and we were done. So it really does vary quite a bit. In the same way that that number can go up if you're using barrel gas that's been stored out in other places, there are things that make that more expensive.
Okay. Yeah, I guess a key thing, and I guess this really is illustrated by the $1,800 an hour, is that anything to do with science is expensive, has a markup.
Yes. I mean, aviation is expensive in general, so that might be the, but the point is accurately taken. If you take I'm going to pick on Fisher just because that's the big company. I don't mean them specifically. It's not just them. It's more science. So if you take a bag of elastic bands that you get at the grocery store or at the home or the office supply store, and you sell it at a science company, say it's stamped with Fisher or VWR or whoever it is, it becomes like 5 times more expensive. Maybe they're better elastics.
Are they 5 times more sciencey, stronger?
I'm sure they are.
Less contaminants.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah, for sure. But the idea is that, you know, it's expensive to make things in very clean facilities out of very consistent material. So there is a reason it's more expensive, jokes aside. But just some things are quite pricey. And everything related to science tends to be pretty pricey.
So although sometimes numbers sound large, they don't go as far as you think in terms of the grants?
No, they definitely do not. Especially as inflation gets expensive, it continues to be a thing. Hotel costs are insane at the moment. If you've just booked a trip for personal travel, everything is expensive. There's no cheap conferences anymore. You know, the days of, because I'm also on the SCAS, Society of Canadian Aquatic Sciences executive, and so planning conferences is one of the really big things. And legitimately, people, you know, take note of the fact that registration costs are very high. The cost of hotels is very high. Travel is, but you know, the markup that we get is effectively nothing on those. Like that is just the cost of doing business. Literally, the days of cheap conferences are gone, unfortunately, because everything is so expensive.
Oh man, it's a depressing note. I'm gonna end the show on some more positive notes. I guess we never really spoke about overhead, and
no, yeah, it's
I don't
true.
Know if it really fits in, but one thing that stuck with me.
Maybe we could leave that for the university one too, because really, in some ways, because we are intending to talk about universities. Like, overhead is how the university funds a lot of things too. So we should make a note to tuck that in there. But it is the part just as because we have said it. Do you want to give the definition of what overhead is, really briefly? You don't get to see it, but it does.
It pays my salary.
And yeah, exactly. Adam loves overhead.
Overhead's the best. I work on commission.
Hell, it pays my salary too. We're not kidding. No one's kidding anyone here.
But so basically, I don't even know what this is, but on every grant, basically the university will take its cut. It'll take a small amount of the... that are going, not necessarily a small, depends on the particular.
I was going to say.
But it'll take a amount that of proportional to the direct cost of research. And that amount can vary, whether it's just coming from a partner, coming from a partner, but then being matched by an agency, coming directly from an agency, or I guess we never really mentioned like the more specific type of grants where a smaller foundation may have a very targeted grant that you apply to, and they will limit certain things by saying none of these funds may go towards overhead. And that's just basically...
Or no more than 10% or any of those kind of...
Yeah. Of the... just a portion of all the grant funds that the university basically portions off for itself for the cost of running the university. And I guess because we talk about never having to worry about the lights, the electricity, or the... you know, the gas meters outside, the Bunsen burners, for example. An analogy that stuck with me a very long time ago was of research labs as sort of a protected small business within the university. So you're not worrying about those very basic infrastructure type things in terms of like, or costs is like light and heat. But you are in the business of writing grants that will give you the funds to get, which are the sort of like the contracts to do the work that you're interested in doing, which... drew you to the life of academia in the first place.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. It's a very good one to keep in mind.
And
I am the CEO of a very, very small business.
And so I guess a topic for future talk would be like, which should be the more preferable CEO of a small business within a, you know, a university kind of setting? Or, you know, the independently wealthy gentlemen scholars of yore that had unlimited freedom to do whatever they wanted in terms of, you know, measuring the charge on electrons in their basement.
Yeah, exactly. That is a debate. You know, there are good things about working in a big team, but also, you know, you just go out and trounce around and collect some rocks and barnacles and draw pictures of them and... once a year go to London to give a paper at the Royal Society in your tweed plaid suit.
Yeah.
It's a simpler life.
and there were no constraints other than, I guess, general society's constraints upon what was acceptable where at the conferences.
Yeah. Gentlemen scholars indeed. Yeah. Lots of them. Yep. All right. I think that's a pretty good, I'm sure that was not all of the knowledge, or not knowledge, all of the things that bounce around inside your head, but a few of them for sure. Did we get any mail this week?
We did not. And apparently...
any toots?
I tooted, but... but no one responded to my toots, for better or worse. Yeah. But
okay. Or tweets. We're talking about Mastodon, guys.
It's the joke. Anyway.
Yep.
Once again.
But no one knows we have those handles. We just have to make it very clear.
That's why we're going to lay them out right now in the closer.
Here we go.
So thank you for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology podcast. If you have a question or a comment or perhaps a suggestion for a future show, please send us a note.
Our email address is coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. Our Twitter X handle is @coreideas, so that's kind of defunct. Our Mastodon handle is @coreideaspaleo@mastodon.social. So same as the Core Ideas Paleo Twitter, but now at the mastodon.social, and we read everything you send us. It doesn't take long, even if it takes us a couple days to get to it.
Yeah. And an archive of our past episodes and show notes is maintained on our website at ajzerowski.ca. But the easiest way to find that link is just check out our Twitter or Mastodon bios.
And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating, subscribe, leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get those favorite podcasts. We love those 5-star ratings and comments. They're few and far between, but that's okay because we're just still doing this for fun.
And that's it for today. But we will be back soon to explore how money fuels academic research in more detail, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy, even when talking about the economy of knowledge.